Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Bill Hartung of the World Policy Institute, who assesses world reaction to President Bush's recent pronouncement that in the war against terrorism, the U.S. must act against three nations identified as an axis of evil. Abigail Dillon, an attorney with the group Earth Justice, who examines tactics used by the Bush administration to undermine or eliminate environmental regulations. And Peter Hart, an analyst with the Media Watch Group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, who takes a look at the large amounts of money given to journalists by the failed Enron Corporation before its recent collapse. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
One of the tragic truths of war in many parts of the world is the extent to which children are routinely kidnapped or enticed into military service. The United Nations estimates that there are 300,000 soldiers under age 18 serving in conflicts around the world. According to the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientist, underage girls were active in conflicts in 32 nations. Despite this, they say international humanitarian groups rarely address the needs of these girls when disarmament and demobilization take place. The problem has long been ignored by language that defines underage combatants as child soldiers without considering gender. The true dimensions of the problem have only been revealed in recent years when the Coalition to Stop the Use of Child Soldiers began compiling statistics. The Kosovo Liberation Army recruited internationally, which is how 16-year-old Alinda Mariki of the Bronx joined the war with her parents' support. She received 15 days of training before being sent to engage Yugoslavian troops. Other girls have been pressed into service in East Timor, Cambodia, Sri Lanka, and Turkey. In Sri Lanka, the rebel group Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam runs its own orphanages and draws many soldiers from these institutions. The Convention on the Rights of the Child has begun a serious international effort to curtail military recruitment of children. An overwhelming majority of UN member states have ratified the convention. Only the United States and Somalia have failed to do so, a fact widely criticized by Western governments and human rights groups. The Nation magazine reports that fallout from Enron's aggressive financing techniques has been felt halfway across the world, most notably in India. The saga started in 1993 when Enron signed its first contract to build a 740-megawatt power plant in conjunction with the state government in the Maharashtra province. But opposition Hindu politicians blasted the plan as more evidence of corruption by the ruling Congress party. 2 years later, however, when the opposition party came to power in the region, it canceled the Enron contract. Party leader L.K. Advani blasted the deal as loot through liberalization. But the Enron power plant was far from dead. After efforts by U.S. Ambassador Frank Wisner to revive the plant, regional authorities started to renegotiate the deal in 1995 and a year later signed a new contract. In the fine print, Maharashtra authorities agreed to pay Enron $430 million for phase one of the power plant and committed to a new 1,624-megawatt power plant. It was quite a deal for Enron. The politically connected energy giant would pocket a $14 billion profit from the deal, double the rate of return allowed by Indian law for similar projects. Today, power from the Enron plant is twice as expensive as local power alternatives. In January 2001, the Regional Indian Power Authority stopped paying Enron's bills and 6 months later axed the Enron contract despite the pleading of American Vice President Dick Cheney and his key Enron friends. It's been nearly 125 years since the last wolf roamed the deep woods of New England. That was before the invention of the car, the strip mall, or vacation homes. As the population and agriculture grew, however, the wolf was seen as a dangerous predator and eventually exterminated. But times have changed in the North Woods, where spruce trees have grown thick again and moose and deer have returned in droves. Now environmentalists are pushing to reintroduce the gray wolf, the top predator, back into the woods of upstate New York and northern New England. But according to Forest magazine, there is strong resistance to reintroducing the wolf from farmers, loggers, and sportsmen in the region. The states of New Hampshire and Maine have passed laws trying to stop the reintroduction of the gray wolf. Wolves have been reintroduced on federal lands in western states such as Yellowstone and national forests in New Mexico and Arizona. Yet in the Northeast, most of the land is privately owned, creating more hurdles for bringing back the gray wolf to New England. Right now, northern Maine appears to be the most logical spot to reintroduce the wolf, boasting 18,000 acres of thick forest and big herds of moose and deer, the diet of choice for wolves in the wild. Ann McMichael of the Maine Wolf Coalition readily admits the public is not ready for the gray wolf. She adds, "We do not want the wolves in Maine where they are in danger of being destroyed because of the public's fear." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Rich Fraser. For Between the Lines, I'm Jeff Wignall.
In his State of the Union address delivered before Congress on January 29th, President Bush singled out three nations, Iraq, Iran, North Korea, and their terrorist allies, who he stated constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world. The president went on to say that the U.S. must act against these regimes to deny them the materials, technology, and expertise to make weapons of mass destruction. While the president did not specify what actions America would take to achieve his goals, the governments which Mr. Bush threatened reacted with anger and charged that the accusations leveled against them were baseless. But longtime U.S. allies in Europe were also critical of the bellicose tone of the speech. French Prime Minister Lionel Jospin warned that neither American unilateralism or military means alone will reduce the threat of terrorism. Chris Patten, the European Union's Commissioner for International Relations and former chair of Britain's Conservative Party, accused the Bush administration of a dangerously absolutist and simplistic stance towards the rest of the world. This criticism comes as U.S. military advisors have been deployed to the Philippines, and speculation grows about a future U.S. assault on Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Bill Hartung, director of the Arms Trade Research Center at the World Policy Institute, who questions the effectiveness of the U.S. war against terrorism and the world reaction to President Bush's axis of evil comments.
Well, the axis of evil comment was sort of an exercise in whipping up the right wing, I think, of the party, showing them that he was their guy. And I think he surprised even some of his own people. Apparently, Richard Armitage, who's Colin Powell's deputy at the State Department, thought he had convinced them to take that little piece out of the speech. And he got a lot of flack from European allies, many of whom trade with Iran, many of whom were upset when the Bush administration decided to drop the talks with North Korea that the Clinton administration had started, under which North Korea was on the verge of signing off on a deal to cap their ballistic missile program, stop exporting missiles, and stop producing them in exchange for some help with their energy needs and some food aid and some sort of understanding from the United States that they were not considered an official designated enemy subject to attack, whenever the U.S. president felt the urge. In the case of Iraq, their nuclear program has pretty much been shut down since the sanctions were put on. You know, what Saddam Hussein may be doing in terms of biological and chemical weapons is less clear, but they're not going to find out by bombing the place. A lot of the sort of fellow travelers of the Bush administration, like James Woolsey, the former head of the CIA, were itching to blame the anthrax problem in the United States on Iraq, based on an alleged meeting between an Iraqi and a bin Laden person in the Czech Republic and various other arguments. But when it became clear that it was a domestic source, at least that's still the reigning theory, they just kept at it. So I think that's all very troubling. I think there are going to be debates within the administration about whether to really go after all three of these countries. But there's no question that people like Paul Wolfowitz, who sort of represents the hardline position, would want to do that. So I think Bush kind of was at this pinnacle where it seemed like, you know, he could do no wrong, at least in terms of the mainstream interpretation. I think a lot of that is going to start getting chipped away once people realize that what he's doing really isn't going to solve the problem of terrorism, and that treating it as a military problem has a lot of negative repercussions, not least of all that it puts our country in a position of killing large numbers of innocent people.
Is there any evidence that with the overthrow of the Taliban government in Afghanistan and the bombing of numerous locations where the Al-Qaeda fighters were supposed to be stationed, is there any evidence that the U.S. has broken up that network and forestalled any future terrorist attacks?
I don't think so. I mean, you know, there's no question they kept some of the Al-Qaeda fighters who were based in Afghanistan, they kept them busy for several months because they were running from bombs and relocating and so forth. But this organization allegedly operates in 60 different countries, and the group that carried out the World Trade Center and Pentagon attacks was mostly built around some students who went to engineering and technical schools in Germany. And they may have had contact with bin Laden and his chief people from time to time, but essentially they operated independently. And I think that's my understanding of how the organization works. So as long as they can raise money and as long as they have some networks with people who are willing to be careful, take their time, will risk their lives to do these sorts of things, they will very likely still be able to operate.
In terms of the European Union's attitude towards what the United States is doing, there does seem to be some cracks appearing in the relationship. Are we headed for rough relations with the Europeans over our post-September 11th foreign policy, do you think?
Well, I think a lot of that is really in the hands of the Bush administration at this point. People had been giving them the benefit of the doubt, I think partly because they just didn't want to take on the United States. They were hoping that Bush didn't mean what he said. They were hoping there was some way to sort of smooth this over without having a direct confrontation. But after some nice talk about coalition building after September 11th, essentially Bush administration has gone back to where they started. He walked out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty. You know, Rumsfeld has been very gruff and persnickety about the questions raised about civilian casualties, treatment of prisoners, are we, you know, observing international law, as if these are just sort of minor irritants instead of sort of major principles on which we're trying to build a more stable international community. But yeah, I think this administration really has the possibility of alienating European allies, despite the best efforts of Putin to try to maintain good relations with the U.S. despite all the things where they've gone against them. Likewise, in the case of China, you know, I think if they go down this path, there's going to be all kinds of political and economic ripple effects that the Bush people are not going to be able to manage. But I think the problem is those effects will happen over years. You know, while their focus really seems to be 2004. I mean, they have a pretty short timeline that they seem to be working on, which is, you know, how can they posture as a strong administration and get Bush reelected? I think that interest contradicts the interest of having a more well-thought-out policy.
That was Bill Hartung of the World Policy Institute. Contact the Institute by calling area code 212-229-5808 or visit their website at www.worldpolicy.org. Whether it's snowmobiles in Yellowstone National Park, arsenic in our drinking water, or the country's millions of acres of roadless areas, a number of environmental organizations trying to hold the line claim the Bush administration has a plan for rolling back environmental protections. They say that when environmental regulations are challenged in court, the administration responds with a weak defense, but then claims when the regulations are reversed that it is not to blame. Some environmental groups point out that public opposition to President Bush's stance on environmental issues was quite strong before the September 11th terror attacks. They claim that since then, government officials have tried, and in some cases succeeded, in carrying out environmental policy behind closed doors. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Abigail Dillon, an attorney with Earth Justice, a public interest law firm with headquarters in San Francisco and regional offices around the country. Dillon, who is based in Bozeman, Montana, examines the tactics used by the Bush administration in dealing with environmental law and the harm which she believes has been the result.
Some of these have been attempts to make end runs just around our environmental laws. For instance, the right to appeal Forest Service decisions such as timber sales. Another thing that they've tried to do is roll back administrative regulations, and those are different from laws in that they aren't enacted by Congress. They're rules that the administration comes up with in implementing or managing, say, our forests or our national parks, the administration will decide how best to do that. And before Clinton left office, his administration had made quite a few really protective rules, most notably the Roadless Initiative, which would have protected millions of acres of our national forest from roading and logging. Those are the kinds of things that are quite easy to roll back because you don't need to go through the legislative process to do that. The administration isn't saying, hey, we want to roll back these rules and we want to make new rules and we want to go through the legal process to do that. What we're seeing instead is that industry groups who are very tight with the Interior Department and Gail Norton in particular are bringing lawsuits and they're challenging these regulations. And then in court, the government does not mount a vigorous defense and the judge overturns the rule and the administration can blame the courts rather than their own policies for the environmental rollback that results.
It doesn't seem like it would be that surprising that a new administration from a different party would come in with different, you know, goals and values and use these kind of procedures. Is this any different than any other administration has done, which is different of a different party than the previous one?
No, I think that you are hitting the nail on the head. It's not surprising for a new administration to adopt new policies and want to change the rules. What's interesting here is the way that the Bush administration is trying to change the rules. They're not doing it out in the open, and they're not doing it by involving the public, and they're not doing it through our rulemaking processes where the public has a role and where everything happens in the public eye. What they're doing is they are in cahoots with industry. Industry brings a lawsuit, and then a judge overturns the rule so that there's no political accountability. The problem for the Bush administration is a lot of these environmental protections were enormously popular. The roadless rule was supported by millions and millions of Americans, and I think the Bush administration is quite worried about how they will be perceived if they take the blame for rolling back that rule. So what they've elected to do instead is say a judge in Idaho has blocked this rule. We still believe in roadless values, but we have to go back to the drawing board because this rule is illegal. Well, we have reason to believe that the district court's decision was not well-founded, and the government has not elected to appeal that rule. And they're still saying they care for roadless values, but we don't know what that means when they're unwilling to guarantee any concrete protections to these areas. I think what's happening is that this is just greenwash, and if they really want to roll back the roadless rule, they should do it themselves through an administrative rulemaking where they'll be politically accountable for doing so.
What is Earth Justice doing? Are you guys have your hands really full now opposing these kinds of efforts that the administration is either undertaking or not defending? I mean, not defending the existing regulations. How do you deal with that?
Well, we have a lot of cases, and they all play out a little bit differently. For instance, the Yellowstone snowmobile rule was a rule that the Clinton administration put into effect just before President Clinton left office, and it would have phased out snowmobile use over the next couple of winters. And when the Bush administration came into office, they said that they were going to let that rule go into effect, and they made some political hay out of supporting protection for parks. But in the meantime, before any reductions in snowmobiles actually have to take place, Bill Horn was on the Bush transition team and has close connections to the Interior Department, brought a lawsuit saying that the snowmobile phase-out was illegal. The federal government, instead of defending the rule, settled the case and said, we'll go back, we'll do a new process, we'll look at impacts, and we'll come up with a new rule. But how that played out in terms of the press was the Bush administration supports the rule, and they got very little press on the fact that, in fact, behind closed doors, they settled the case, and we expect them to come up with a new rule shortly.
A new rule that would be less restrictive of snowmobiles?
That will keep snowmobiles in the park, yeah, exactly. These are the kinds of issues that we're dealing with, and it's frankly frustrating. I think a lot of it feels like just trying to protect the kind of protections that we've gotten so far, and instead of moving forward, we're just trying to prevent a backslide.
That was Abigail Dillon of Earth Justice. For more information, contact Earth Justice at area code 406-586-9699 or visit their website at www.earthjustice.org. As Congress continues its examination of the collapse of the Enron Corporation, the single largest bankruptcy in U.S. history, many observers remain skeptical that Republicans and Democrats, who received millions of dollars in campaign contributions from the failed energy giant, could conduct a thorough and objective investigation. The strong connections between Enron and the Bush administration raise many more questions about the prospects for a credible inquiry. Attorney General John Ashcroft has recently rejected calls for the appointment of a special prosecutor, despite the fact that as a recipient of Enron campaign contributions, he was forced to recuse himself from the Justice Department probe. But Enron didn't restrict its attempt to buy influence on Capitol Hill, with $5.8 million made in political contributions since 1989, mostly to Republicans. Powerful journalists also received large amounts of money from Enron. These reporters included Bill Kristol of the conservative Weekly Standard, Paul Krugman, a columnist with the New York Times, and Lawrence Kudlow of CNBC and the National Review. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Peter Hart, an analyst with the Media Watch Group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, who takes a look at the ethical questions raised by these journalists' relationship with Enron and the favorable coverage which may have been purchased.
The business, Enron as a business, relied on two things, really. It relied on deregulation of the energy markets, so you needed to spread around money in the political system to get that taken care of. And from what we know, they did that, and they did that well. We were the ones who lost, you know, citizens in the states where there was electricity deregulation, but nonetheless, that's what they were doing. This other, you know, the second fact about Enron, you know, they needed deregulation. They also needed a lack of scrutiny and some good public relations to maintain this really fictional business that they had going on, creating markets where really there weren't markets just a couple years ago. So that first point we're pretty clear on at this point. That second point, though, is the one that we're talking about now with the treatment that Enron got in the media. And it looks like some of it was paid for. They spread around money to a couple of fairly prominent, mostly conservative pundits, people like Bill Kristol, who edits a magazine called The Weekly Standard, conservative Murdoch publication. He got $100,000 for serving on a board, an Enron board. Lawrence Kudlow, who co-hosts a program on CNBC and is also a pretty prominent television pundit, he got $50,000 for speaking fees, and apparently Enron subscribed to his research firm. That's an interesting question there, because you wonder, he was actually conducting business with Enron at the time, which I guess puts him in a separate category. And then New York Times columnist Paul Krugman, and he got $50,000 for being a board member, kind of like Kristol at Enron, on some sort of advisory board that, according to Krugman, didn't do a whole lot. So you've got them spreading this money around, for the most part, with people, and they're giving the money to people who they'd probably agree with anyway. But as we know from campaign finance scandals of Enron and other issues, it's important to remind people of the connections that you've made and remind them of what a great company you've got going and how innovative your business model is. So I think that's what was happening with the Enron money. And so far, these people seem largely unapologetic about it and just wish that they weren't tainted by the connection at this point, but, you know, it's kind of too late for that.
Do you think we'll ever get to the bottom of this thing, given Enron's money flowed to both Democrats and Republicans and, as we've learned now, journalists?
Yeah, I mean, if you're looking at how politicians are going to investigate it, and you enacted some sort of policy where politicians who took money from Enron would have to recuse themselves from the investigation, you'd see senators and congressmen left and right who would have to walk away and say, well, yeah, they gave me money too, so I really couldn't fairly judge what's been going on. At that point, you understand how wide their influence was all over Washington and state governments as well. Powerful journalists are like powerful politicians. And to ask really tough questions about the very nature of the system could be very damaging to them. So I think, if anything, the questions that are going to be asked about Enron are somewhat limited, even though, you know, you and I, and I think most people know, there are all kinds of questions that you could still ask. How many other companies use the kind of bogus accounting practices that Enron's been found guilty of using? How many other companies were able to buy this much access to politicians? These are serious questions, and you could probably employ dozens of reporters to try to answer those questions. I think the story is relatively simple. I think the corruption is relatively simple. What it takes now are people that can connect the dots between these different players and the policies that they wanted to get from the government. We need journalists to do that. We need journalists to explain how this worked, where the money changed hands, and what that money bought. And at this point, there don't seem to be very many journalists who are willing to pursue the story in that way.
Are there hard and fast rules by publications and television networks for full disclosure of this kind of money coming in that could certainly put into question people's objectivity when they report on companies like Enron?
It sort of depends on the outlet, but at the end of the day, those companies aren't giving the money because they're charitable, and they want to make nice with reporters. They're doing it because they expect something from that relationship. And in journalism, probably more so than in politics, you are absolutely obligated to free yourself from those kinds of relationships and to explain where the money comes from and what it buys. So when you have a case of a community media outlet or a community radio station, people know where the money's coming from. It comes from listeners who support the station because they like what they hear. What lesson are we supposed to draw from the fact that a corporation gives a journalist $100,000 other than that corporation must like what they hear from that journalist? And unfortunately, that kind of transparency isn't built into our media system right now, but it certainly should be.
That was Peter Hart, an analyst with the Media Watch Group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Contact FAIR by calling 1-800-847-3993 or visit their website at www.fair.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, Jeff Wignall, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.